How did you develop the Miss Manners persona?
Well, I noticed it in the mirror one morning, and so I thought I might as well move into it. I have always loved tradition and antique etiquette and developing etiquette, and so I decided to come out in the open with it, see if I could persuade other people to follow.
Are you interested in people behaving correctly, or is it something else you're trying to get at?
Well, it would be a start if they stopped behaving rudely, and then we would worry about the fine details later.
Why isn't doing what feels natural good enough?
That is what everybody is doing in the streets today. Is that good enough for you? I despise the idea of everybody doing what feels natural. It always turns out to be a disguised form of being nasty to other people.
Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do believe it's true, of course.
I think part of the block that a lot of people have about manners and behavior patterns and etiquette is that it's sometimes really a class distinction system. And looking at how someone behaves, if you decode that, can tell you what class they're from and how they were brought up.
To some extent. I think it's interesting that people regard manners as a luxury of the upper classes that they don't need to bother with. Same people, of course, are madly buying all kinds of status symbols to try and look as if they belong to a higher class. And manners are free. That's one of the nice things about them, good manners. But it would be as if you looked at a $2,000 dress and said, well, since I don't need that, I don't need any clothes. I mean, there are manners that require a certain amount of outlay, but they are in the way of flatware and such. But they're an infinitesimal part of manners in general.
I still think, though, that there's some kinds of behavior things that you know are really upper class, that only people who've really had it bred into them behave that way.
And there are fewer of them every day, too. The people who had it bred into them are rapidly expelling it, I'm sorry to say.
You said that there's really three classes now. Do you want to describe them?
The lower middle class, the middle class, and the upper middle class. Yes, nobody ever admits to belonging to anything that isn't somehow middle class. But behaving properly was never the exclusive preserve of the upper echelon. It's an American tradition that families, no matter how poor, had their Sunday best behavior and their best clothes and their sense of decorum. That it is not a pure luxury item.
Well, you suggest that everyone finds the middle class despicable. Why do you think that
is? Oh, everybody likes to pick on everyone else. And one of the most interesting times for etiquette chroniclers such as myself are when you get a really good class battle going, because one class is trying to move into another. For instance, the Industrial Revolution, when you had a rich middle class trying to move into a impoverished upper class, and that's why you have all those interesting Victorian manners, because the people on top try to throw up barriers as fast as they can. They keep inventing new things, and if you don't do that, you can't get in. But funny thing is, if you have enough money, eventually you do get in anyway, don't you?
What class is it that say covers up the living room furniture with plastic so it doesn't
plastic is the lower end of the scale. Chintz in the summer is a little higher.
What about not using the fancy
wearing
china?
It out and then throwing it out or reupholstering it, or wearing it out and then keeping it is your really upper class behavior.
What about not using the good dishes ever because you're afraid they'll break?
Yeah, that's pretty low on the scale, yes. Someone told me a marvelous story, I don't know if it's true, about Mr. Niarchos having a Rembrandt on his yacht and being asked by the guest, well, wouldn't the salt air destroy it? And he said, well, probably eventually, but I was always taught that if you have good things, you should use them. So my mother said about the silver teapot. It's rather interesting to hear it said about a painting. As I say, probably not true, but that's the basic idea.
Well, earlier today, I took an informal survey of the WUHY staff to find out what kinds of circumstances or situations pose behavior problems where people aren't really sure what to do or what's appropriate. And I'd like to pose these questions to you and get your suggestions of appropriate behavior. This one comes from our news director, Nick Peters. You're at a restaurant, and this is either a business meal or a friendship meal. The check comes, and one person picks it up and says, oh, you know, I want to pick up the check. And the other person says, oh, no, 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 no. How do you handle these little check battles, and at what point should somebody give in?
Yes, there is a little ritual that goes back and forth. Oh, no, let me take this. And the other person says, no, no, I'll take it. Third time around, that's enough. And you let someone get it. And then you say, well, now the next time, remember, you must let me take you. And that's very flattering because it implies there is going to be a next time, which if you spent the whole evening battling over the check, there probably won't be because it's probably a very tedious evening.
Is it ever okay to say, say you were going to pick up the check and the other person says, no, 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 let me do it or let's split it. Is it ever okay to say, okay, I won't pick it up. You win.
Well, you put it rather harshly, didn't you? I thought my way was a little more gentle of next time you must let me take you out. I mean, I accomplished the same thing. The other person pays the check. I have just done it more gracefully, if I may be so bold as to say so.
Okay. This is another one from Nick Peters. You're going to somebody's house. It's either a dinner party or a party. You're bringing a guest with you. You're bringing a friend with you. Who do you introduce to who? Are you introducing the host to the guest or the guest to the host? Is there any...
I hope that the hostess or the host knows that guest is coming and has specifically invited that guest. The idea that people's houses are like discotheques and you can bring a date to anything, which I might say has gone up to the White House the last couple of administrations. Everyone can bring a guest. I don't like that. I think you ought to be able to decide who's coming to your house. And you can say, oh, do bring that lovely young man that I saw you with the other day or whatever. Then you find out the name. So the hostess should know the name ahead of time. Then you introduce your guest to the hostess.
Okay. Another one from Nick Peters. How do you tell a man that his fly is down in a public setting?
As soon and quietly as possible. There are two categories of hideous things that people can have wrong. One is the absolutely irrevocable. I mean, you've split your dress down the back and there's nothing that you're going to be able to do it. Then you pretend you don't notice. If there's something that can be fixed, it's classically called the spinach on the teeth situation. You've had an evening where you thought you've been devastatingly charming and you look in the mirror as you brush your teeth and there's spinach on your teeth. Why didn't someone tell you? Zipping up the fly comes in that category, unless it's the end of the evening and it's too late. Do not let that poor man go home and when he gets undressed suddenly realize that he spent the whole evening running around like that.
Okay, this next question comes from our director of development.
Have we solved all of Nick Peters' problems?
Yes.
Thank goodness for that, yes.
This next question is from Eve Glicksman, our director of development. When you're dealing with someone in a business situation, how can you tell whether you should be calling them by their first name or their last name?
You should not be calling them by their first name. I think that's despicable. It puts a pseudo air of friendship that does not really belong. If it's within your own office and the boss says, oh, call me Joe, and he's trying to pretend you're equals, wait till labor negotiation time if you really think you're equals. I prefer formality in that. And at the very worst, if someone does not like that, he can say, oh, do call me, you know, by my first name. But people who start out chummily in business situations, I don't care for it.
Okay, let me just reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Judith Martin, who writes a column in the Washington Post under the name Miss Manners, and she's written a new book called Miss Manners' Guide to Excruciatingly Correct Behavior. And what we're doing right now is surveying some of the questions brought up by the WUHY staff earlier today. This next one comes from one of our reporters, John Barth, and he says, say you're in a restaurant with a good friend of yours who happens to be kind of loud, and at this restaurant, they start talking loudly, perhaps a little on the vulgar side, and it's a little embarrassing to you. What's the...
You're sitting there with a rowdy, drunken friend. Is that what you're saying? Or not necessarily drunk.
Not even necessarily drunk.
But rowdy.
Just a little too loud.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the basic rules of etiquette is that the rudest thing you can possibly do is to correct other people, which you may notice I do for a living, but at least I'm asked, right? And so my tendency would be not to worry about the other person's behavior and let him worry about that. You could say, I can hear you, as a sort of a hint. But even then, responsibility for the behavior of your friends or your spouse can get you into deep trouble. I mean, I do think that one of the great secrets of a happy marriage is that you are responsible for the way you behave, he's responsible for the way he behaves, and you don't sit there and die of embarrassment or figure out ways to improve the other person's behavior.
Let me just escalate this one degree then. Say you're in a public place with a friend of yours who's talking very loudly, and it's about you. You know, it's about something you've done or your exploits.
Somebody
together
is broadcasting your private life all over a restaurant.
You've got
then
it.
Then I think I would say I would rather discuss this later in private.
Okay. This next question is from Pat Ford also.
Unless I was at the other table, in which case I would sit there listening, pretending to eat my fish.
Okay. This one comes from Pat Ford also, a reporter at WUHY. You're on a first date with someone, and it hasn't gotten really clear yet who's going to be picking up the checks or anything. Do you have any suggestions on that?
Oh, in the good old days, all we worried about was should you kiss on the first date. Now it's who should you pay on the first date, isn't it? There are two systems which are mutually exclusive, in effect. One is the gentleman pays, and the other is that you either take turns or split the check. It tends to be generational. At my age, I would tend to let the gentleman pay the check. If I were a student where other rules prevailed, I would do that. But the thing I really can't bear is to let me see who had the extra dessert and did you have two drinks or three. So that I think if there's any doubt that I would just pick up the check myself and say, oh, next time you can take me.
Pat also wanted to know if you think it's still inappropriate to wear white or black to a wedding, which is something that she was brought up thinking that you weren't supposed to wear white or black to a wedding.
She's brought up correctly. You don't, yes. You don't wear white because you don't want to upstage the bride, and these days the bride could be wearing anything, so you could be mistaken by all the out-of-town relatives. I suppose you could collect a lot of silverware that way, but it's not quite fair. You don't wear black because it's the color of mourning, and you don't want to cast a pall on someone's wedding. It leaves you quite a few colors to wear, actually.
This next one comes from Angela Charamella, who is the secretary, receptionist, and also does a lot of public relations work here at WUHY. Okay, she sits at the desk when you enter the reception area for the station, and she has all her work to get done, and at the same time, she's in a kind of public position where as people are waiting to meet the person who they've come to meet, she's the person who's visible. What do you think would be appropriate for her to do in terms of relating to the other people who are there while she is really trying to get her work done?
Well, part of her work is being the receptionist. And if there is a full-time receptionist job and there is a full-time job involving other work, if I were she, I would bring this up.
As you can see, she does about three jobs.
Yes, she's got two jobs there. Common courtesy requires that she pay attention to the human being and then get back to her own work. And if that isn't possible to do her own work that way, I would certainly point out if I were she to my boss that I needed some help.
Here's something else she runs into.
Have I solved everybody's personnel problems around here as well as their etiquette problems?
Here's another problem Angela has. Sometimes she's sitting in the reception area where her desk is when working, and here's some of the guests being really quite catty about the program that's on the air at the time or about one of the program hosts or someone else at the station. Should she act as if she's not really hearing this?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful thing. Just officially nothing has been said. Otherwise, what's she going to do? Get in, jump into somebody's conversation and defend the station and so on? No. You should not be allowed to eavesdrop unless you can do it with a straight face, meaning that you pretend to be staring out in space and you're taking it all in, but you do not react.
Is it appropriate?
Saves you a lot of trouble that way, too.
Is it appropriate after they leave for her to tell us what was said?
Certainly. Get some nice criticism that way.
Okay, here's Angela's last question. You're at a restaurant with, say, five or six people. The bill comes. How do you divvy it up?
Well, you ask for separate checks when you sit down. And one of the things that annoys me terribly is every once in a while when I say that, I get a letter from someone in the restaurant business that says, well, it's an inconvenience for them and so on. Well, I mean, whom are they there to serve? It's for the customer's convenience that service should be performed, and you just arrange it beforehand.
Okay, this next question comes from Jay Goldman, who's an engineer at the station, and he wants to know when you're out with a date, when is the appropriate time to bring up that you're recently divorced?
Most people seem to think the appropriate time to bring up your recently that you're recently divorced is right after you say how do you do, and I think a little less of that the better. You are not. It's a harder question would be when should you bring up that you're married when your date doesn't know it. I don't think a recent divorce is at all necessary to bring up until you get to a point of exchanging confidences, recent or ancient. There is all too much together too much these days of pouring out little details of people's lives, and it really spoils the excitement for when you get intimate.
Here's another question from Jay. You've asked a woman out on a date, but you don't have a car. Is there an appropriate way of asking her
to pick you up?
Well, not to pick you up because you have a motorcycle and can get to where you're going, but you couldn't drive her around.
I would offer to pick her up on the motorcycle, and I dare say she would volunteer to meet him wherever they were going.
Okay. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Judith Martin, who's also known as Miss Manners. That's the name she writes her column under in the Washington Post, where she also reviews, under her own name, theater. Her new book is called Miss Manners' Guide to Excruciatingly Correct Behavior, and it's published by Athenaeum. Okay, this is a question from Danny Miller, the associate producer of Fresh Air. You're out on a date with someone. You've assumed you're splitting the bill and you're each paying for your own ticket. You realize once you get there that the woman who you're with isn't under that assumption and that she's actually expected you would be paying.
I would pay. What are you going to do? Appropriate her jewelry and sell it? No, this is a clash of systems. This is why it is an interesting and yet perilous time in etiquette, because people do go under different systems, and I think the graceful thing to do there is to pick up the bill.
See, you don't have the money with you.
Then it isn't so graceful, is it? Because you take a bad check and you get arrested the next day. Of course, she doesn't see that. Not even a credit card? I wonder, I'm a little short, I wonder if I would borrow from you. I think that would be the last time you'd see her, though.
Say you want to make plans to go out with a couple of people to, say, go to the movies. This is another question from Danny. And one of the people is really a part of a group that tends to travel together, and you only want to go out with this one person from the group. Is there an appropriate way of either making that clear? Or,
what is it, a group marriage? I mean,
No. It's a kind of group of friends who always hang around together.
Well, you assume that people, no matter how closely bound they are to others, even married people go socially about separately sometimes these days. Actually, the rule is the less conventional the arrangement, the more conventionally people want to be treated. It's very interesting. But I would say, would you like to go to the movies? Now, you does not include six people. And if they say, well, let me ask Jane and Joe and Mary and Sam, and you could say, well, I just wondered if you would be free. But that would be rather cumbersome socially to always have to be invited around with six other people, especially at dinners for eight.
Here's another one from Danny. How do you tell people to be quiet at the movies when people are either playing their radios or talking loudly?
Aha, you call in a third person. Sometimes that's purely a formality because the usher may be a little kid who's more frightened than you are. But it cushions the thing, and you say to the usher, is radio playing aloud in here? It's really disturbing me, you say. And you're not talking to the person behind you who's going to whop you one if you try and say, shut up, that thing, I'm trying to listen. But the message has been conveyed.
Okay, here's some of mine. How do you end a conversation with someone who's going on and on and on, and you don't have an easy way out?
Are you talking about on the air? Are you trying to tell me something?
Yes. No. off the air. On the air, it's kind of easy.
I would say, well, it was so nice to see you. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're at a party or some kind of business function, and you're introducing somebody to somebody else. And you realize you've forgotten one of their names.
If you've only forgotten one name, you don't have any problem because you say, oh, you must know so-and-so, and then you give that one name that you do know, and then you kind of scoot around, and the other person, with any luck, looks up and says, well, I know, I don't believe so, and the first person says, well, I'm that. The trick is when you've forgotten both names. You want to know how to do that? And then you say, I'm sure you two must know each other, and then you quickly tie your shoelace. And there they are, staring at each other, and they say, why? No, I'm so-and-so.
I've been in situations where there's no way in the world the two would know each other.
So what? I mean, you assume that You say this, I mean, everything doesn't have to be literally true in the etiquette world, as you may have noticed. That's the first rule. And secondly, it's rather flattering that you assume that one or both of them are so well known that they must have run into the other.
Okay. You're at, again, say a party or some kind of function. You're introducing a bunch of people to one another. And some of the people who are there are people who have jobs with important titles, and you'd kind of like to know, in introducing everybody, you'd like to tell what it is they do and how they spend their days. But on the other hand, some of your friends are unemployed, and some of them have jobs that they really hate and don't much want to be associated with or to talk about. So how do you make everybody comfortable in a situation like that?
The best thing to do is an old Foreign Service trick, which is American diplomatic wives all know this. You send a little note to everybody else at the embassy with a little background on each of the guests, but they don't know you've sent it. I don't believe in introducing even your great famous friends with all their titles. You introduce everybody by name, and then you give some sort of tiny hint about what something they could talk about. The low point I've ever heard in this, I was once introduced to a woman at a party and said, she said, "This is so-and-so, and you should know each other. You're both mothers of sons," said the introducer. And we sat there and we looked at each other. I thought that was an all-time low. A nice little hint of, you would probably enjoy talking to each other. You're both pilots or whatever is fine. But this is the famous so-and-so whom you have seen on stage and screen, I think is just as insulting as running out of things to say about someone. That's what conversation is all about. They're supposed to start probing and finding out about each other.
Say you have a business contact or a professional contact who you're meeting for the first time. For me, it might be to do an interview. And you want to be gracious and you want to be cordial and friendly. But this other person who is a man has said something that is really sexist in the extreme. How do you handle it?
This is a perfect example of how manners are not, as many people claim, simply trying to make other people feel comfortable. You don't want to make someone who has made a sexist remark feel comfortable. Now, I do not believe in rudeness or the snappy comeback or whatever. I am very good at the icy stare. Or the frozen smile, the one where you just look right through the person and so on. There are all kinds of forms of politeness specifically designed to make other people feel uncomfortable. But it does not detract from your graciousness because you haven't done anything rude. It's too bad it's radio. I can't do my icy stare for you. I assure you it's quite splendid.
Are there any words, verbal suggestions you'd have?
Well, when it's a sexist remark, say if it is a racist remark, and the person assumes that you share the feelings, some version of "Did you know my husband was one?" or something like that, charmingly said, will usually put people through the floor. A sexist remark is more made to a woman is more difficult because the man is making the outrageous presumption that the woman thinks that's funny when he is really insulting her. And I would stare in disbelief, but if that isn't good enough for you, you can also say, "I don't quite understand what you're saying." I use that for dirty jokes when I don't care to be told dirty jokes, as when I used to do composing room work in the Washington Post and on the lobster shift when all the printers would get paid overtime if they drew things out. I could go home when things were done. It was always dirty joke time. And so I would look at them and say, "I don't understand that. Would you explain it to me?" And they would turn crimson and leave.
So someone in your family has done something very sexist. Your father, your uncle, your cousin.
I think I would sit down and have a quiet little talk with him. There is a little bit outside of the realm of manners and into what I would consider education. Again, one doesn't do things rudely, but I don't think I could quite live with the idea that a member of my family was being bigoted toward myself.
You're just joining us. I'm speaking with Judith Martin, who writes a syndicated column under the name Miss Manners. It originates in the Washington Post, and it's featured in Philadelphia in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Well, those are a sampling of the questions from the staff here at WUHY. We've started to talk a little bit about sexism and manners. What are some of the occasions or rituals or behavior patterns that have really been changed by the women's movement, and
we are moving away from a gender-specific set of rules into more of an age set of rules, where a young woman would get up on the bus for an elderly man, for instance, who will probably spit in her eye, because that's one of the hazards of chaotic times, as I said, just as many women are quite rude when a man opens the door for them. I'm against all forms of rudeness, and I think the least we can do is accept intended politeness as politeness. But I do see it evolving away from that. There were a lot of red herrings in the etiquette field of people who thought that feminism would be so difficult from an etiquette point of view that we couldn't possibly have equality. The Supreme Court went to pieces last year over the idea, because they've always been addressed as Mr. Justice, what's going to happen if and when they had a woman. Well, it would have been very simple, Madam Justice. Madam is a perfectly good word, even though it is used for a variety of professions. But so they just dropped the Mr. altogether. But I remember tremendous arguments of, my goodness, how can you have a cabinet member who is a woman, or an ambassador? What would we do with her husband, and all that kind of thing, which is all very silly, because the rules work for officials and their spouses, and it works just as well when a woman is in the position of power as it does when a man is. I mean, that's nonsense. So most of those problems, when you look at them closely, they simply disappear. But the question of precedence, which since the Middle Ages has been more or less based on the idea that the strong yield to the weak, which replaces the previous system, which has more logic, which is that the weak, more logic but less charm, that the weak yield to the strong. The question is, who is weak? And women don't like it. The disabled don't like it. In many instances, the elderly don't like it. But at least the age system gives everyone a chance. And one has to have some form of precedence. And I just see it becoming less oriented toward gender, as I say, and more general. Which doesn't do away with courtesy. Courtesy is still courtesy.
How do you deal with it when someone opens the door for you, and a man always opens the door for you, and it's not because you're encumbered with packages and briefcases and he's not?
He is intending to be polite, and I accept it as a politeness. I think that there is enough rudeness in the world without people taking as insults things that were kindly intended. I mean, this man's mother brought him up to open doors for ladies, and you're going to sit there and chastise him for that?
What if you see it as being symbolic?
Well, one cannot take manners too literally. Folk custom always lags a bit behind the philosophy of the society, and one has to allow for a graceful lag there.
In many marriages now, the couple hyphenate their names, so they have two last names, or at least the woman has two last names. I think, do men do that too?
Sometimes. Boy, are they going to run into trouble when their grandchildren start getting married.
That's my question. What happens when two hyphenated children wed?
Yes, you have a very long wedding invitation and a large bill from the engravers. That really is not a satisfactory solution, but I have not got a satisfactory solution to propose. Indeed, I think it's quite upsetting to lose one's original last name, as women have always done. The hyphenated one is not much of a solution. The inventing a new one is not much of a solution. I don't know. Why don't we just go through the maternal line? That's what we did before we unfortunately let on that men had anything to do with making children in the first place. The maternal line is always very clear. And in many instances, because of divorce and whatnot, we are getting back to a matriarchal system.
That would be
worked fairly well.
That would be pretty radical for a lot of people, don't you think?
Yes, I do.
You recommend it anyway.
Well, it worked for millions of years before marriage was invented, didn't it?
Who still calls, what kind of women still call themselves Mrs. Husband, in other words, like Mrs. John Doe? Like, where is that considered appropriate, and when should you respect that? Or should you always respect that? And how do you
Everyone has a different system on names these days. This is what makes life so difficult, except for people in the etiquette business, for whom it makes it interesting. Some people who want to be addressed right away by their first name, some people who use the title of doctor, and some people who have it and don't use it. The hyphenated names that you mentioned. There are women who use their maiden names in work and their married names out of work. There are every conceivable system is in use. The least you can do is find out what people wish to be called and address them that, as they wish, and not be offended if everyone doesn't automatically know the particular little way that you like to be addressed. Again, it's a generational thing. There are a lot of women who prefer the formal name, Mrs., with their husband's first name. One never calls oneself that, of course. But that is the proper formal way to traditionally to address a married woman. Now, if a woman finds that offensive, I wouldn't address her that way. But nor would I insist on modernizing the name, so-called, of a woman who likes being addressed that way.
What gives you problems? Do you ever not know how to behave?
No, I always know how to behave. That's my trade in stock. I always know how to behave.
I bet you have to cover up a lot for the times when you're not sure.
Why, what a rude thing to say. Now, have I been rude to you?
No, I mean, seriously, do you have to say it's a really unclear situation where there is nothing that seems especially appropriate.
Well, then you can't do the wrong thing, can
right.
you? If there is nothing that is required to be done, then you can't go wrong. If there is something that's required to be done, I'd do it.
What?
Isn't that a wonderful system? I never have to feel guilty, never have to feel embarrassed.
What kind of manners were you brought up with?
Proper manners.
What kind of family?
What kind of family? Well-behaved family. My father was a government economist. My mother was a school teacher. If the question deep down is, were they maniacs that ran up and down the dinner table slapping our elbows, the answer is no. But if the question is whether they preferred the type of household that I prefer and live in, where there is a certain amount of decorum and consideration and politeness, the answer is yes.
Have you brought up your children with basically the same set of behavior systems as the one you were brought up with?
Yes, I have. You probably think, oh, the poor little things, don't you? There's always this tremendous amount of pity for my children because they have to give good manners. It's entirely misplaced, I assure you, because the idea that the child is the noble savage who should not be inhibited by good manners results in a rude child. And also a very insecure child who doesn't know how to behave in different situations.
Would you punish your kids for not behaving appropriately?
Do I beat them senseless if they take the wrong fork? I mean, that's really what you mean. I bring up my children to have good manners. You could make the same argument by asking me, did I toilet train my children? Well, of course I did. I mean, one civilizes one's children. That's what it is to be a parent. But is that an undue hardship? No, it isn't. Actually, it's a great favor that you do children, because then they're free. They're not worried about how they're behaving.
In your book, you talk about how you like the idea of Sunday best, and it's nice to have some occasions where you just bring out all your special things and use mm-hmm. them and enjoy them. What are the Sunday best type occasions in the life of your family?
Well, for instance, we all have tea time on Sunday afternoon, and my son makes the tea, and my daughter makes something for us to eat, and we've done different things at various times. Sometimes everybody has to memorize a poem. We did that for a few years and recites a poem, or sometimes we have Shakespeare Day. Everybody does that, or lately we've been reading Charles Dickens' History of England at tea time. Dinner is a family occasion. We're all on very busy schedules, and so it's a great treat for us. It may not seem exciting for an outsider that at dinner time everybody freshens up a little and sits down, has a nice meal, and tells everybody else what he or she's been doing that day. That's called family life, and it's really very pleasant.
Let me change the subject again. The Reagan administration has really tried to bring a lot of sense of occasion and, I think, privilege back into the White House, a kind of reaction against the Carter informality.
Excuse me, but I, as a native Washingtonian and one who has covered the White House for years and years, I have to tell you that both of those things are myths. There is a basic Washington official style of entertaining. It's not very flashy, but it's perhaps more formal than other cities. The Carters did it. The Reagans did it. The idea that the Carters were hayseeds who ran around barefoot in the White House and that the Reagans are examples of unparalleled elegance that have just dazzled us poor natives are equally untrue. They both, state dinners are the same in those administrations and in all the previous ones I've covered. I'm so sorry to explode that widely believed myth.
What do you think of the way the Reagans are using their wealth?
What do you mean specifically? I don't approve of diamonds before luncheon, but
Well, for instance, the china, the very expensive china, and the very expensive dresses.
Well,
that
you know,
Nancy
as a
Reagan
journalist,
wears.
I always hate to side with any administration, but the fact is that the ceremonial side of government life, which in England, for instance, they pay a whole family full of people to do and pay them extremely well, we dump on whoever is married to the president. And this is on down the line. It's dumped on diplomatic wives, which makes it extremely hard, I might add, on women diplomats. It's dumped on military wives and so on. And traditionally what we do is we demand that the First Lady, whether she likes it or not, whether she's fit for it or not and so on, do all the official entertaining of the United States at the highest level. And then we say she's selfish to want to have the dishes for it. Well, for heaven's sake. I mean, if we really feel that way, why don't we pay people to do this? I think that would be a very sensible arrangement. But you're asking for very heavy volunteer service there. And women in other areas have rebelled against this, and rightly so. But the problem has not been solved. For instance, the Foreign Service wives made it, State Department make very clear that they were not required to do the United States official entertaining. But they never provided anybody else to do it. So the result has simply been that the junior wives do not feel the responsibility, but the ambassador's wife is still stuck with it with no help. And we have never solved that problem. And so I tend not to jump on people who do a great deal of free labor because they seem to want the equipment to do it with.
But getting back to something like the China again, it's maybe a question of what we were talking about earlier, the places where class distinctions and etiquette get a little blurred. The
official entertaining is done with a high degree of formality in every country. It's rather standard. Some countries have wonderful resources like old palaces and the furniture left by former monarchies and so on. We don't. We tend to do it on a fairly simple level. But nevertheless, you really deep in your heart don't believe that we should do our official entertaining on the china that you get as premiums at the bank or from gas stations. You want to do it on standard formal things so that other heads of state, when they come, do not snicker. Now, if you find that unbearably pretentious, I don't, really.
But you could say they wouldn't have snickered at something a little less inexpensive. And again, the kind of blending of etiquette
you're
and
talking
politics.
About degrees, okay. Didn't match, I don't suppose anybody would have died laughing at the china. But every once in a while, you do have to renew the china at the White House. And I don't think that compared to the defense budget, it's something we ought to spend our time debating. Also, it wasn't paid for out of the budget, if you recall.
Right, and then you can ask, like, what, you know, and any development director has to ask this, what are your priorities? You only have a limited amount of time to do fundraising. What are you going to spend that time raising funds for? And you can only raise
so much. All
right,
but the fact is that part of the job in the White House is ceremonial official entertaining, and that has to be done.
Okay. How do you know what to wear to an occasion that you're invited to, whether it's a political function or a Washington Post party or a wedding?
Well, political functions are fairly standard. It's a wedding I would think would be fairly standard, although there are some bizarre local customs in places. But the difficulty is that all the words have become meaningless. The word informal, for instance, is totally meaningless. Once upon a time, informal meant black tie. Now, in some places, it means that shoes aren't necessary and shirts are really superfluous also. And one isn't even safe by saying to the hostess, well, what are you going to wear? Because she says, oh, I'm going to wear a caftan. And you don't know if it's a $2,000 job with jewels sewn on the back or her bathrobe. It has become difficult because things are not quite as standardized as they were. But I think it's fair to demand that one's hostess give one a fairly clear idea of what's being worn.
When you answer letters, are they all letters that have really come in? I've always wondered if columnists write the letters that they answer.
I would consider that highly unethical to make up letters, and also a great deal more work. Took me over 20 years in the newspaper business to discover how easy it is to have a column where your readers do half the writing for you. Those letters are all real.
So what's on everybody's mind, judging from the mail that
romance,
comes in?
Romance? What did you think?
And what are the big problems about romance?
The different styles of courtship, different speeds of courtship, things you've brought up today. Who pays? Do you kiss on the first date, which, as I say, is become a euphemism? Sex is on everybody's mind, of course, as it always is and always has been.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great fun to be here.